KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Five young leaders in science, arts, academics, and Native cultural understanding are this year's champions for change. They include a Yale student who sees a way to use AI to assist Native Hawaiians clear criminal records to become better participants in society. Another champion sees creativity connected to culture as a way to foster healing. We'll hear from these young leaders coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Anchorage, Alaska area has its first small-scale casino. The Aklutna tribe began operations on Monday night in a building in Birchwood. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, it was constructed in less than a week.
The whirlwind effort to get the tribe's gaming hall up and running is in sharp contrast to the decades it spent fighting for the legal right to operate it. So why the hurry? Did the timing have anything to do with a new president? While Trump celebrated his inauguration, you could hear the steady roar of machinery at the tribe's casino. Construction equipment raced around a five-piece modular building, bolted together and propped up on wooden blocks. Even so, the Chenan Gaming Hall opened early that evening, and Dan Amadon was the very first to feed money into a gaming machine.
You put a little in, you get a little back. That's the fun of it.
Amadon operates a shop next door. And although this patch of land outside Anchorage still seems more like a construction zone, Aaron Leggett, president of the Native Village of Aklutna, called the first day of operations a historic milestone for the tribe. The building sits on a Native allotment that a year ago did not have the necessary Indian country status for gambling. But last year, the U.S. Interior Department changed its Alaska policies, and the tribe got final approval from Brian Newland, the outgoing Assistant Secretary of Interior, just 5 days before the Trump administration takeover. Don Mitchell, the lawyer for property owners who have sued the tribe, believes the scramble to open was to head off the governor of Alaska's request to Trump to block the casino.
And they somehow think that by opening up a symbolic casino, that will improve their legal position.
The tribe says it's not so much fear of Trump, but fear of more delays caused by turnover in administrations. It says once it's in full operation, its small-scale casino will be an economic lifeline for its members. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Tribal leaders in the Southwest are addressing concerns from their tribal members as the Trump administration rolls out the president's immigration orders, which include deportation plans. The Navajo Nation, located in the Four Corners region, and the Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico say they've received concerns this week about circulating stories of tribal members being approached by U.S. immigration and custom enforcement agents in urban areas. The Navajo Nation Council on Thursday urged Navajo Nation President Boone Igren to take immediate actions on what it said are raids in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The council says it's sparking fear. Nigren says as of Thursday night, there were no confirmed cases of detentions of Navajo citizens, but he's asking Navajo people to stay informed, remain calm, and carry a state-issued identification card. In a letter Thursday to Mescalero Apache members, the tribe stated it verified one incident where an ICE agent questioned a tribal member in a neighboring town. Mescalero Apache President Thora Walsh Padilla addressed concerns in a social media video message to tribal members, asking them to report any encounters.
We're very, very worried about our tribal members at this time, that such things like this could happen in this day and age, and we are doing everything we can. I mean, remember that we are the indigenous people of this area, and we are also a sovereign nation, and we do have rights.
The tribe's working with New Mexico's congressional delegation and has posted information on its website for tribal members about how to respond if confronted by U.S. immigration agents. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com who support this show. Skugdash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Yeh.
Support by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow since 1922. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The Center for Native American Youth's New Champions for Change includes five inspirational Native young people who are recognized for their positive work and leadership in their communities. One of the champions is helping design and develop an AI tool to expedite Hawaii's criminal records expungement process. Another is preserving intellectual property and data from her community by digitizing audio, photos, and documents. Today we talk with these young people and others from the latest Champions for Change cohort about the work they do for their communities and why it is worth highlighting. As always, we want to include listeners like you in the conversation. Please join us with comments or questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also leave a comment on our website or social media pages like Facebook, Instagram, Threads, or Blue Sky. Let's now meet today's guests. Joining us from Anadarko, Oklahoma is Lily Painter. Her Kiowa name is Brings Water. She is a 2025 Champion for Change. She is Kiowa and Winnebago. Congratulations, Lily, and welcome to our show.
Hi. Oh my gosh, thanks so much. I'm so excited to be here. I feel so official.
We're excited to have you very much. Also on the show today and joining us from Phoenix, Arizona is Lourdes Pereira. She is Hiachit Otham and Yoime and a citizen of the Fahano Otham Nation. Lourdes, congratulations to you too and welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, we have Katie Lynch. She is a 2025 Champion for Change. She is from the citizen band Potawatomi Nation. Congratulations, Katie. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
And joining us from New Haven, Connecticut is Joshua Ching. He is a 2025 Champion for Change. Also, he is Native Hawaiian. Joshua, congratulations. Welcome. So happy to have you on the show along with our other guests.
Aloha. Thank you so much. Super excited to talk more.
Aloha. There is another Champion of Change who couldn't be part of our discussion today, but we want to mention Marurak Nanuk Jones. She is a Nupiak from the native village of Unalakleet in Alaska, and she studies environmental science at Western Washington University. So we want to congratulate her as well. And Lily, we're going to go ahead and start with you today, and let's talk about the work that you do and your background and what inspires you. You have creative passion as both an artist and a writer. You're also passionate about Native issues. Tell us how these pursuits intersect.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely as a young person, trying to find where that intersection was sort of interesting. I always refer back to one of the first times I remember, like, very concretely writing, like, a story. And it was, like, fourth grade. I was super into, like, King Arthur fantasy stories for some reason. And I remember sitting there writing, like, in my free time at recess about this, like, female knight who was in, like, this king
kingly place, and she's in like she's at the round table and everything's going great. And I kind of, you know, did that and threw it away. And I recently came back to it when I was just starting to sort of try to find where I knew how to organize around issues. And I went back and I found that story and I read through it. And I realized that I had, you know, unconsciously written like a native character. Like when I looked back at her description, it was very much someone who had looked like me when I was that age. And I was like, wow, that's like kind of crazy to think that, you know, unconsciously we're putting ourselves into these spaces that we didn't know. Like, you know, you don't, nowadays you do, but back then you weren't reading, you know, a lot of stories of natives putting themselves in these, you know, sort of uncharted spaces. And, you know, I found that that impact of that and sort of that core was where I knew that there was something there. I knew that, you know, at such a young age that there was something that was coming out in the way I was expressing myself through writing. And to me, you know, as I've grown through the year, that has, you know, maintained its truth. I've found it's just the easiest for me to use that traditional knowledge of storytelling embedded within writing. And it's not just writing, you know, fiction. Like I don't really write that much about knights anymore, but, you know, writing in different ways, poetry, screenwriting, plays, and also op-eds, how we use our storytelling capabilities to write informatively for not just natives, but non-natives and other demographics that need to know the issues that are going on in Indian country.
You really are a visionary all those years ago as a child. and that's amazing. Yeah. Because now it's like, we hear so much about native female warriors and native female empowerment, and definitely ahead of your time, Lily. Well, tell us more about your creative process. And when you set about creating a piece of writing, maybe a piece of poetry or a play script, what are you thinking about in terms of that person who's going to see it or hear it?
Yeah, I think I really do find a guiding path to a lot of it is what would I have wanted to read when I was growing up. I mean, I am such like a nerdy, just love anything in the arts type of person. And it, you know, a lot of it is, you know, if I'm writing for younger people or I'm writing like your short stories or young adult stories, it's like what I've wanted to see, what would have made me do the thing where you like put your hand on the book and you have to use your hand to cover the rest of the book because you love it so much you have to read ahead. Like you have to keep yourself from spoiling it. I try to chase that same sort of drive, the same feeling that, you know, I would have wanted to feel. And then as for brainstorming, I think it's a lot of, you know, I try not to look at things in the deficit. I think that's something we see so much with, you know, when people bring forward more, well, in their words, concrete, you know, methods of activism or advocacy, it's always in the deficit. It's always, hey, we're pushing forward this bill because here's the state of reservations and the youth there are hopeless. It's like, no, that's not how that works. So I like to approach it from something of, you know, if this is the deficit, what's the adverse of that? What's the hope? What's the message that you learn from the trauma that's going on? You know, how are we not just focusing on these stories of peril?
And the ability, the power of artwork to educate people, does it have any limits in your view?
Definitely not. I think, you know, I was really fortunate. I'm also an educator, so I've had the privilege of working with a lot of children for the past 4 to 5 years in a completely tribally run summer camp that we do down here in Oklahoma. It's really great. And, you know, if I didn't know before, I definitely know now that, you know, art is so, it's not just subjective. Like we know that it's like, oh, people throw paint on a canvas and they're like, that's not art. But, you know, the things that some of these kids that I'm teaching come up with, it's stuff that has, I mean, my jaw has like been on the floor for a lot of it. You know, I don't shy away from teaching, and they're native students. I don't shy away from teaching them about, you know, our history. Cause you know, if they're young enough to have experienced the effects of living in the history native people have had, they're also old enough to learn about it. And, you know, we always do sort of some way to incorporate the art and expression through what we just learned. And the things that some of these kids bring to me is, you know, it's absolutely amazing. It's anything from just a drawing of themselves standing, like hugging a tree, to a bracelet that they made that reminds them of a native book that we read, to a bookmark that they were like, oh, I want to use this to put in my water protector's book. You know, it's anything and it's everything. And I think, you know, not limiting ourselves is
the real key to understanding like how impactful art can be.
I'm glad you mentioned books, Lily, because you're also part of a project that we've talked about multiple times on our show, yes. The Indian Girls Book Club. Tell us more about how that project is going.
Book club. So yeah, it's founded by my friend, poet. I know you guys know her, Kinsale Drake. And, you know, it was sort of founded through that same thing that I was just talking about. Like, Kinsale and I both grew up as writers. We both grew up very nerdy. And we were sort of kind of fending for ourselves in an age where it was hard to connect with other Native people on the basis of kind of nerding out over a really good book. And, you know, that's what led us to each other when we were both, you know, 11, 12, 13 on the internet, just probably when we shouldn't have been on the internet, but kind of just finding each other. And we've been friends ever since. And the idea of book club came out of not just that idea to create a space for people to, you know, be able to talk about these things, but to bridge that connection that non-Native, that the non-Native literary world doesn't really seem to want to make willingly. Like, it's a lot of trying to bridge publisher to author, author to audience, you know, audience to each other. And it's really just the promotion of literacy as well. Literacy is reading and it is writing, but it's also everything that surrounds it. So it's just a really great, it's a great program.
And the kids that you work with, sometimes I worry a little bit that kids might not be reading as much nowadays with so many other competing interests, video games, internet technology. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, there's definitely a world for both. I mean, as I said, I love video games. I love video games. I love all my little hobbies that I get from someone who just has it's hard to be a one-track brain for me sometimes. And I know that's the case for so many of our Native students as well. You know, it's just a lot of things that people like to look over. And I think the importance of reading I think it's shifted, obviously. Like, book fairs are very different than they used to be when I was in school. But I think really the key is tackling the core of it, which is the storytelling. What's the story about? I think, like, when I describe a lot of the youth books that we talk about with the kids, I like to say, I like to connect it to something they know. Like, if they really like the new Percy Jackson show that's out on Disney, it's like, oh, hey, guys, this is like Percy Jackson, but it's better because he's Native. And they're like, no way. I'm like, yeah, this guy's like Native Spider-Man. He's great. He was the original Native Spider-Man. You know, stuff like that. And it's the story, you know. I think Western education has sort of put this idea in students that not just that books have to be boring, but that you're making them read it because it's like, you know, whatever.
Okay. All right. So, Lily, you've just scored some points with my daughter, who's 11 years old. We're reading the first Percy Jackson book right now and having a ball. So this is great. We're going to have to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more with Lily as well as our other champions for change. So stay with us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, what are you waiting for? 1-800-996-2848. Even in the age of constant information, television remains a powerful window into people's view of the world. And Native American representation in TV is one way toward a more rounded perspective. We'll hear from Native people in front of the camera about the work they do on the next Native America Calling.
Heshey! Elia nishi yam ketsa nishi ton ate atunu na ton ice manna. Asna ton is ayu yana kadiahnan ton is yamakwa bos awa shua pluta is to visit healthcare.gov/coverage kinawa nanta ton is 1-800-318-2596 and penan akadawa. Look at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services ton na penan itu lokenawe. Elahkwa.
check. She wanted to have a little bit of fun just for one night. To become one, we could run from the sunlight. What have you done? Mixing lust with your love life. Trumpet with one mic, drummer in an upright. Couple couplets cut tight, and there's cut loops. It's hard to trust anyone when they love through. Had a little trouble letting go, but people run a different path than a different road. Better run a show, run an explore, rest for a couple days and just took a chance.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We are talking with this year's 2025 Champions for Change class about the work that they do for their communities. Please voice a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848, 1-800-996-2848. Our first champion on the show, Lily Painter, joins us from Anadarko, Oklahoma. And Lily, I want to ask you one more question before we move on to our next champion. And in addition to all your artwork and your reading, the work you do to promote and foster reading in communities, tell us about some of the issues, the Native issues that you're most passionate about right now.
Definitely education currently. I think, you know, there's a reality where, you know, our communities are going to have to band together to make sure that our Native kids are getting the correct education of our people, but also education that's going to lead us forward in a future where we're considerate of the issues that are going on in the world, climate change. And, you know, I started out organizing really heavily in the missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls and Two-Spirit movement. And so that's, you know, something that's always close to my heart. And something I think that's really important to note is, you know, these issues are never just singular. They're, you know, just as Native people are interconnected in the ways that we, you know, go about the world and our non-human relatives and each other, you know, so too are these issues. You know, everything connects at some point with one another. And, you know, that's why this program is so important, is it's about banding together, and the unity of organizing on different fronts to combat, you know, these things is also the reality that we together are the ones that are paving that future forward for Indian people. So, yeah, there's definitely not one core passion area, but I'm definitely excited to get to work on those specific things.
All right. Well, we're excited to see what more you have in store for us, Lily. It sounds like you're just getting started, but thanks again for coming on the show and sharing a little bit about your life and your pursuits.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Let's move on now to Lourdes Pereira, who joins us from Phoenix, Arizona, also a 2025 Champion for Change. And Lourdes, data sovereignty, that's a focus of your work, and it's a topic that comes up on our show periodically. Tell us how you define data sovereignty and its role in the projects you've taken on.
Hi, yeah, I'm excited to be here. I'm super passionate about data sovereignty. And I think the term data, it's just so broad. And I think when people are thinking about data, right, we kind of go to like computers, we think about computers, calculators, just a lot of tech. But I actually worked in a library for 4 years, an Indigenous library called Labriola. It's actually at ASU. And I learned a lot about information. And really, when we're talking about data, we're also talking about information. And that's what is directly connected to the work that I do. So I digitalized over 400 microcassette and cassette tapes of my great-grandmother speaking in our traditional language in the Hiatcha dialect. And, you know, I had to go through learning about organizing this information, where to hold this information. But definitely it was a different perspective from me when we're talking about data sovereignty and what that looks like for Indian country. It's our stories, right? It's really a part of, so not just the records, right, when you're going to an IHS or a hospital, not just that type of one-sided way we're used to seeing data, but more information, I would say. It's tied to so much of what we do, and a lot of Native youth and a lot of folks, right, on Facebook or Instagram, those types of platforms, that's also a form of data, right? It's very broad and super inclusive of just different information, things like that.
This all sounds really exciting. Tell us a little bit more about the process. I'm really interested in hearing how you sat down with your great-grandmother who spoke in your people's language, and how do you capture that data? How do you record? How do you safeguard it? How do you share it? Mm-hmm.
So actually, my great-grandmother, Philemon Bell Childs, she was actually born in Kitkito, Arvaipia, which is just right down from Ajo, Arizona. She was the one who led that initiative. She went to her village, within her village, recording her elders, and they were just talking about really from what we're gathering in the process currently, and I don't want to jump ahead too much, of course, the work I'm currently doing, they're really talking about place names, the area, you know, where people are buried, information around medicine and all these incredible things. She was the one to record that. So while I was working at Labriola, I was learning a lot from Alexander Soto, the executive director at Labriola. He's an archivist. He's also a librarian. He taught me a lot of what I know today. And at the time, Labriola was hosting CDA workshops, and that's a community-driven archives workshop. And what that does is really shift community. It's community-led. And it's supposed to teach community that, you know, we don't really need to depend on these larger institutions or museums to teach us how we need to care for our information. Because as, you know, Native people, we've always done that. It's mostly been oral-based for a lot of tribes, but we've always, you know, known how to take care and preserve our own information. And that's what I really loved about CDA and was interested in. And I went back home one day and I went into the garage and I saw these tapes, just happened to come across it, and these like plastic bags. And, you know, I'm from Tucson, Arizona. And so these tapes that were recorded in the 70s, right? They're in this garage that's like 120 degrees, you know, in the summer. And I'm just like now freaking out. I'm like, oh my gosh, mom, like what's going on? And she told me the story about the tapes and everything. I had a little bit of an idea of what was on them, but not to this full extent. Once we really started listening to them, I applied to a $10,000 grant, and I was able to digitalize all of them. Really, some of them, of course, weren't active, but my mentor, my boss at the time, really taught me how to organize this information. Currently, we have it on a master guard, so it's off any type of platform, Google, anything you would we get with the internet. We currently are not, it's not on any of those platforms, because a really large issue around data sovereignty is, you know, who is the steward of this information?
Right,
what we see
right.
within Indian country is that a lot of tribes are not stewards of that information. A lot of museums and other larger institutions have full stewardship of that. So what we're trying to do, the lens we're trying to come from, is making sure that we have full stewardship of our own information. There are other platforms we are looking at, which is like Mukutu. I'm not sure if anyone here has heard about that. But that was created in Australia by the Aborigines, so it's Indigenous, you know, led and created, and that's for other Indigenous people to use and basically be able to upload. It's basically like a repository, and the tribe has full say on who has access to that. Okay, so maybe now that it's winter time, we're going to be closing off certain stories, and if you're a tribal member, well, you can put in your tribal ID number or however the tribe goes about that, and you'll have access to wintertime stories. And this is all guarded, too, by local context, which is broken down basically by TK, traditional knowledge system. So maybe some stories are just for women, maybe some stories are just for Two-Spirit folks, or, you know, like I said, this is only supposed to be in the wintertime, things like that. And we can do that digitally now, which is so awesome. And that's currently what I'm working on with my tribe, is how we're going to make sure that this information is protected and that we continue to be stewards of it.
Lourdes, what about other tribes? Do you have other communities reaching out and wanting to take advantage of your expertise and do something similar for their people, their languages, their cultural history?
I don't have any tribes currently reaching out to me. I do have some things in the work that I'm excited to bring to other tribes if they're interested in learning more about this, because every tribe I have talked to thus far is really interested. I think currently, just off of my own perspective and expertise, I know in Arizona specifically, there's only two tribes that currently have policies and laws that do protect their intellectual property. So the Pascua-Yaqui tribe, and then you have the Hopi tribe, and that's written in their laws that, you know, no one's supposed to be recording their ceremonies. But they're really thorough about their law, but out of 22 federally recognized tribes, you know, and in Arizona, it's surprising that only two tribes are having these types of conversations. So I hope that not just in Arizona, but across the nation, that we start having more of these conversations and seeing that written in our law.
Lourdes, how many hours do you think you have invested in this project? It seems like it would be very daunting. It would be very labor intensive.
I could not tell you. I'm so sorry. I honestly, it is. So I graduated from ASU in 2023, and I was doing a lot of this work with digitalizing, organizing these tapes when I was an undergrad getting my bachelor's. So it was a lot of extra hours, but it was just so much fun. And I mean, even now I work full time, so it is easier for me. But I love how I organized these tapes. We had to do like a sample size of just translating with one of my elders, Fernando Martinez. And we don't have many speakers, so it's an absolute privilege to sit down with him and listen about our history, about, you know, medicines, our things we used to do, just all of that traditional knowledge, to be able to hear that firsthand, right, sitting right next to him, learning. It is an absolute privilege. And I've learned so much in that process too, and how to engage with elders, right? I was just, it's a little short story, which is really cool. I learned how to burn a CD actually doing this. I never burned a CD before.
You make me feel old now.
But my elder, for to make this technology more accessible for our elders, you know, he requested to have this burnt on a CD. He didn't want to use the computer. You know, he has a flip phone. He's really straightforward on how he likes to go about things. And so I had to burn these tapes for him to, and then we had to actually go to like a pawn shop to get a CD player for him to listen to it, and like the headphones and everything. And it's just, he liked to touch it. That's what he wanted to be able to click start. He wanted to be able to click, you know, going back and doing those things. We've only just kind of scratched the surface on translating. But I just have so much fun with it. I really don't even focus on how much time I've dedicated or keep track of that, because it's just such important work to me.
The labor of love, for sure. Geez, I remember the first time I was able to burn a CD. I thought it was like so cool and cutting edge. Now it's completely antiquated technology.
Lourdes, so thank cool you. It is.
Yeah, so yeah. Cool. Getting, you know, just the whole process of it. Lourdes, thank you again for coming on the show. This is so exciting, and we just wish you all the best going forward, and good luck with all this project and anything else you accomplish going forward.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. You bet. Our next 2025 champion for change, Katie Lynch, is from the Citizen Band Potawatomi Nation. She joins us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, where she is a student at the University of Michigan. Katie, hello again. And we're going to switch gears a little bit, because you are pursuing a career in public health research. What drew you to that field?
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for having me today. I think growing up, I was always interested in going into a career that I was able to help people with. Being involved in community service growing up, the importance of serving my community is something that was instilled in me from a really young age. So as I started going into high school, I really started exploring what it would mean to go into a field that related to medicine. And when I was in high school, I was able to attend a magnet high school that focused on engineering and marine technology. So I was exposed to STEM education really young. And I think that in and of itself really propelled me forward into a career, particularly in the health sciences. But when I was in high school, I really found that I liked math and science. And I tried to figure out, like, how can I combine this passion for math and science with my desire to help people? And that's kind of how I found biomedical engineering. So I studied biomedical engineering in undergrad. And by the time I finished undergrad, while I was happy that I chose biomedical engineering, I realized that I could not spend the rest of my life in a lab. So I decided to pivot a little bit to focus more on public health. And it's just been such a rewarding experience to be able to hear from different folks in Indian country that work in the health field. And I'm constantly reminded of the people that have really been able to inspire me to pursue this field. I remember when I was younger, I went to some camp called Camp Invention, and part of the camp was taking an item from your house and then bringing it to camp. We called it a take-apart item. And I remember that being the moment that I realized I really loved, like, taking things apart and building new things. So I'm often reminded of that and, like, how far I've come since then, because it's been quite a journey.
Now, do you have any family members who are also in the public health field, or is this something that you've just taken on completely on your own at this point?
Yeah, so I don't have any other family members in public health. My dad's a surveyor, and my mom, she worked in a high school as a student assistance counselor. So it's been really interesting to kind of chart my own path through this as well.
We just did a show on surveying not too long ago when we were looking for guests. It would have been nice to have known about your dad. We were giving him a call. But no, this is awesome, Katie. And of course, like all of the champions of change, you have a strong community service ethic. And where do you think that comes from, that desire to serve your community and create products or do research that really benefits people that are living on the ground?
Yeah, I think growing up, like I mentioned, the importance of family and community and relationships with each other was instilled in me from a really young age. I was really lucky to be surrounded by really amazing, strong women that taught me from a very young age to speak up for myself and the people that I care about. So I think that really impacted the way that I view my role as an Indigenous scientist and also a scholar activist and a community builder. I think also this appreciation for land is something that I often reflect on. I remember when I was younger, I went up to the Adirondacks in upstate New York every summer, and I also grew up by the ocean. So this appreciation for land and how it has sustained us since time immemorial is something that I constantly have in the back of my head with the public health work that I do, because I know that our health as Indigenous folks is inextricably linked to the land. So I think knowing that and appreciating that growing up has just fueled my desire to make sure that our communities are able to be healthy, and making sure that they have whatever they need to not only run their own health systems, but also to create health systems that are based in Indigenous knowledge and foodways.
Katie, we're going to take another break. When we come back, I want to ask you about the public health issues impacting Native people that you're most passionate about, that you're most focused on. But of course, we do have to take a short break, so bear with us. And for those of you listening to the show today, we've got the phone lines open. So if you'd like to give a shout out to one of our champions for change, or ask a question or make a comment, maybe you are a former champion for change yourself, give us a call. We want to hear your story too. 1-800-996-2848.
MFA programs at the Institute of American Indian Arts, IAIA, honor your voice and vision. IAIA is a tribal university whose low residency programs empower artists, writers, and community leaders through innovation and Indigenous-centered education. Whether your path is creative writing, studio arts, or cultural administration, IAIA fosters respect, dialogue, and community. Applications accepted through February 15th at iaia.edu, who support this show. The Alaska Native Art Auction Gala is March 21st, 2025 in Anchorage, Alaska. Please consider donating art and help Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation raise needed funds. Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation's mission is to be the leader in bringing Native voices to Alaska and the nation. With your support, we're able to produce such programs as National Native News, Native America Calling, and more. Donor forms and more information about the auction can be found at knba.org. Anyone who donates art before February 14th will be automatically entered into a drawing to win $500. Are you or someone you care about looking to take their education to the next level? Native Forward Scholars Fund is here to help. With awards up to $30,000, Native Forward Scholars Fund is dedicated to supporting Native students as they pursue higher education. With Native Forward Scholarships, you can overcome financial barriers and open doors to a world of opportunities. Native Forward Scholars Fund, working to build a brighter future and empower Native students one scholarship at a time. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. See renewal
Global's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. SEE Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com. Educators, ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAInspiredSchoolsNetwork.org, who support this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We're wrapping up our discussion with 2025's Champions for Change class. Please give us a call with a comment or question at 1-800-996-2848. And before we continue our conversation with Champion for Change, Katie Lynch, let's go to the phones. We've got Chanupa on the line. He is in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, as always, listening on Keeley Radio. Hello, big brother.
Hey, I was really proud that you did that, even though we didn't catch it yesterday. But, you know, a lot of the children here on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, when they look to something that's good, like the grandmother for changing something for our elders is one of the greatest things that the elders are doing to this day. They say, Gaku lena wakhanja chikshika wo apkhekile oishpab hanta takomini taku tchokja. See? So in a way of our life, that's how our ancestors did. I was that way too when my grandfather and my grandma used to do that. My grandma Cecilia and my grandpa Roy. And so that's what I want to give to all of you, even our grandmas. Hey, stay focused with your little ones that love you. And the loved ones, man, will give you back the same thing. Wopila from Keeley Radio. Ha-ho!
Aho, thank you, Chanupa, calling in from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, Keeley Radio. Phone line still open for anybody else who would like to join the conversation, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go back now with Katie Lynch. Ann Arbor, Michigan is where she's located. And Katie, public health, that's a very, very wide, wide umbrella of knowledge, of research, of information. What are you most passionate about specifically with public health issues that impact Native people?
Yeah, so I think part of the reason why I love the field of public health so much is because there is so much to do within the field, and it really has allowed me to explore more about what my personal passions are and how I can use those to serve my community. So something that I'm focusing on in my work right now, and I'm only a first year in my PhD program, so I'm still exploring a bit, but really looking at food justice and food sovereignty in our communities and how culture as a protective factor can be really amazing in preventing things like diabetes and other weight-related disorders. Something that I really think about in my research is how can we focus on what's right with our communities instead of what's wrong with them? And I think it was Lily before that was talking about the harms of deficits-based thinking and deficits-based research. And that's something that I often think about in my own research, like how can we really focus on the strength of these communities rather than the weaknesses. So like I mentioned, food justice and food sovereignty, thinking about how can we make sure that our tribes have access to their traditional food ways, and how can that be incredibly healing for folks that might be dealing with things like diabetes. That's something that I'm really passionate about, particularly in the Ann Arbor area. There is a local urban farm called Growing Hope, and they do some really incredible work in making sure that young children are able to learn about the importance of agriculture and gardening and growing their own produce and food. And it's just really amazing to see how much these kids are able to learn just from the land itself and the lessons that they're able to take, not only just in terms of agriculture, but also thinking about how they can use the skills that they're gaining on the farm in their real lives and learning about lessons of resilience and survivance in their own communities.
And Katie, all this work that you're doing, these different projects, these goals, do you see any applications beyond Indigenous communities or even perhaps beyond the United States?
Yes, 100%. That's something that I really focus on in my research is the power of the knowledge that's held within Indigenous communities to be applied in other traditionally marginalized communities. There is just so much immense power in our knowledge systems. And we can really take that and apply it to other communities, particularly when we think about incorporating Indigenous knowledge into health systems to create culturally relevant healthcare interventions. there's so much we can learn from that to apply it to other communities. And I think that's really the power in the work that Indigenous public health scholars have, is that, yes, this is incredibly important for our communities, but it's also important for so many other communities, both here on Turtle Island and abroad as well.
Right on, Katie. Thank you so much for joining the show. Just another inspiring young person making great things happen in Indian country and beyond. Katie, thank you. Go Blue.
Go Blue.
All right. Appreciate it very much. Let's move on now to Joshua Ching. He is also a 2025 Champion for Change. He's in New Haven, Connecticut. He is Native Hawaiian. He is a student at Yale. Joshua, hello again. And let's talk about your project that involves artificial intelligence, or AI. As I understand it, it streamlines the process for Native Hawaiians who want to clear their criminal records. How did you identify this need?
Yeah, so... aloha mai kakou. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm super excited to talk about this. I've been working on this project with the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation. It's the only legal organization in the world that focuses on Native Hawaiian law and Native Hawaiian rights. And we started talking about this because a few years ago, NHLC, which is their abbreviation, they held a clinic out in one of the rural parts of Oahu, which is the island that I live on, to basically address the fact that a lot of Native Hawaiians who were protesting the construction of wind turbines in Kahuku, they'd been arrested, not convicted of those offenses they'd been arrested for, but were having difficulty getting access to jobs, applying to different volunteer opportunities, difficulties in accessing housing. And we identified that the issue, you know, really was the arrest records that they had was publicly accessible, and was really preventing them from accessing those opportunities. And so expungement has become one of those potential solutions that we're looking at that's part of the legal process right now. Anyone in Hawaii who has been arrested for an offense but not convicted of it, and also certain convictions, they can apply to get their criminal records effectively wiped, to increase access to housing, jobs, and all those other things. And so that's what we've been working on.
Well, tell us more about how it works. Let's say, for example, somebody has been arrested while protesting, like you described. What's the first step, and how do they access these tools?
Yeah, so the expungement process is an application that you basically just fill out, and then you send to the Hawaii Criminal Justice Data Center. They process it and determine whether you're eligible or not, all this different stuff. There's a lot of steps in the process. Which is one of the main concerns that we had, is that it's really complicated to understand whether or not you're eligible to get an expungement, because there's a lot of different, like, legal jargon, different things in the statute, but also a lot of things that, you know, you kind of need a lawyer to understand. And so our tool, as we're developing it, is aiming to basically streamline the eligibility process for people who just want to know, am I eligible for an expungement? This is what happened like 10, 20 years ago. I can still find these arrest records. Like, what can I do? And so basically the tool, in theory, as we're working on it, would function to ask them a few questions about what happened, and basically determine their eligibility from there. And then we help them gather the documents, fill them out, and send them off to get an expungement.
So at that point, the AI would just take over, and it would just quickly go through all kinds of data and just get the person the answer they need. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so we've gone through a lot of iterations of the project. Initially, the AI component was more like an assistant, I would say, to explain like whether the, like, if they had questions about the questions that we were asking, because we set up like a big test to have pre-planned questions that would help them determine their eligibility. But if someone, say, for example, like, didn't understand a specific legal term that we were using in the question, the AI assistant would be able to explain that to them in greater detail, in culturally sensitive ways as well, to basically provide them the answer and streamline access to that legal process. We've sort of evolved the way that the AI is working right now. I'm personally not the coder, but I'm helping with the back-end logic that the AI is using to sort of go through the court databases and see what the offenses that they currently have on their record are, and determine eligibility that way, which is a little above my pay grade, but it's really exciting to see and continue to work on.
This is really fascinating. And what intrigues me a lot here is that there's a bigger picture here of you actually working on legal rights for Native people and a component of advocacy. What is the bigger need you see there?
You know, I think that Native Hawaiians, for a long time, we have been struggling in this fight for self-determination. Just last week, exactly 1 week ago, January 17th, commemorated the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, which happened on January 17th, 1893, which also happens to be my birthday, funnily enough. And so we've had a lot of issues that have been part of that legacy of settler colonialism in Hawaii, and that we continue to face today. And so this project, you know, I don't see this expungement project or AI in general to be like a catch-all pathway to Native self-determination, but I believe it can be a tool that with, you know, the right intentions can help us get there. And so when I think about the Native Hawaiian protesters who were at the base of Mauna Kea, our sacred mountain, protesting the construction of a 30-meter telescope on its summit, you know, I remember watching kupuna, like our elders, standing on the front lines, arms linked together, getting taken away in cop cars by the state. And, you know, at the time I was a high school student. And when I had the opportunity to visit and stand on the Mauna with my people, like it ignited some sort of fire in me that recognized that, you know, self-determination is an issue that goes into every single part of our lives in Hawaii. And if there's a tool that can help make that process, the process of whether it's protesting or just getting access to a job easier, then that's a solution that I want to be part of.
Joshua, New Haven, Connecticut, that is a long, long ways from your homeland. Are you able to do all of this work remotely there on the East Coast?
Yeah, so I've been working with the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation virtually. And being here on the East Coast is very different from being home in Hawaii. I can look outside my window right now and there's snow in my backyard, something I will never see at home. but it's been a really great opportunity, I think, being somewhere far away, because I think it's made me feel closer. Like the tether to Hawaii has been strengthened with distance. I think that's in large part due to the really strong Native Hawaiian community that is with me here at Yale, which might be a little surprising, but there's quite a bit of Native Hawaiian students here that I've been able to find a second home with. I owe a lot to my mentor, Professor Hi'ile Hobart. She's the first Native Hawaiian tenure track faculty in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. And so it's just been a really amazing opportunity for me to sort of reground myself and recognize that no matter where I am in the world, there are always ways that I can contribute to the good work that's being done in Hawaii for my lahui, for my people, and that those ties that bind will never snap.
Oh, that's good to hear, Joshua. Now, you've been involved in some other projects in Hawaii as well that relate to e-cigarettes. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, so all throughout high school, I was involved in this long-term advocacy campaign. We'd been advocating for the legislature to pass comprehensive e-cigarette regulations and also a ban on the sale of flavored tobacco products. The main reason being that disproportionately Native Hawaiian youth are overrepresented in the populations that are impacted by e-cigarettes, also disproportionately are targeted in advertising and different marketing tactics that the tobacco industry has used in Hawaii. But, you know, I think that's a story that's also true across Turtle Island. And so we'd been working for a really long time to pass legislation. I'd met with countless state legislators, public policy officials to talk about these issues while in high school, things that I'd seen, you know, in my own time at my school, the impacts of e-cigarettes in my own family as well. And so we were thankfully able to pass comprehensive e-cigarette regulations in 2023, I believe, the summer of 2023. And we were also able to pass a ban on the sale of flavored tobacco products at the county level in Honolulu during 2023 as well. So it's been a super incredible opportunity to understand like how state government works, all the many problems with it, But I'm super grateful to have had that opportunity and sort of be grounded in my home and understanding how it all works.
When do you plan to graduate from Yale, and what are your plans after that?
I will be graduating in 2026. So I'm a junior right now, and I'll be a senior next year, which is a little crazy to think about. It's really flown by. But I think I eventually want to go to law school, start practicing law, go back home to Hawaii is the ultimate goal, and yeah, continue to serve my community there.
Now, I understand you're very close to your family, your parents. We've got about a minute before we have to wrap up, but tell us a little bit more about your family.
Yeah, I mean, my family has been so influential. They've not only been my cheerleaders, but have been the foundation, the shoulders that I stand on. You know, I owe everything to them, and in being able to come out to a place like New Haven, but also just having that really intimate connection with home, it's because of them. And it's where all of my aloha, my love, and my dedication goes to.
All right. Well, Joshua, really appreciate you as well joining the conversation. Congratulations to you again. And keep up the great work, okay? You just sound like such a hardworking and industrious young person. You inspire us all.
Thank you so much.
You bet. You bet. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up this conversation with our 2025 Champions for Change, the folks who joined us on the show today, Lily Painter, Lourdes Pereira, Katie Lynch, and Joshua Ching. Congratulations to them all again. And please join us again on Monday. It'll be Monday when we'll hear from professional and up-and-coming Native storytellers who are working in television. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Joe Thompson is the UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our Chief Operations Officer. The President and CEO of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe, relaxing weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org. See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com. Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. The Association on American Indian Affairs and the Tunica Biloxi Tribe will host the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference, February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2025 in Marksville, Louisiana. The conference will provide expert hands-on training about domestic and international repatriation. Registration and more information available at Indian-Affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Ain't no hold.
Hello.